History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And you know what I'm going to say next. Do they really have to go untold? No, not if we're willing to ask a few questions. And perhaps more importantly, to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only do we become educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up truly inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It is Memorial Day weekend when we pause as a nation to remember all of those who have given what President Abraham Lincoln so powerfully described as their last full measure of devotion, those who have died while serving our country. If you ever find yourself confused about Memorial Day and Veterans Day and can't remember the difference, there's a simple way of remembering that. I haven't heard it said any better than this. While Veterans Day in November is the day where we're reminded that when it comes to our veterans, all gave some, on Memorial Day, we honor the some who gave all. I hope you have the chance this Memorial Day to participate in observances where you live, and why not say a special prayer for our Gold Star families who have the memory of that loved one lost brought front and center again. You may have heard me mention it once upon a time, but the very existence of this program can be traced back to a Gold Star family a century ago when my great-great-grandmother lost her son in World War I. He was one of America's first military pilots. While the focus on Memorial Day will always be those Gold Star heroes who made the ultimate sacrifice, over the years it's also become a time when families reflect on veterans in their families who survived their military service but have since left us. And today we're going to learn about a new memorial which will honor hundreds of them in a very special way at a very special place, and how you can help keep their memory alive. You've heard hundreds of veterans on Hometown Heroes over the years, many of whom I've had the privilege of meeting in their homes, and sometimes in veterans' homes that the government established so no veteran would be left behind. I'm thinking of state veterans' homes we visited in Idaho and Utah and New Mexico and elsewhere where these vets have shared their stories with us. And in California, we've been to the oldest state veterans' home in Yountville to one of the newest in Fresno, which is nearing completion on a special tribute that will end up featuring many of the vets we've heard on this program. To start bringing that picture into focus, let's bring in Julie Cusseter, Public Information Officer for the Veterans Home of California in Fresno.
Well, the state of California is unique in that we have 8 veterans home within the state. And Fresno was the 7th of the 8 homes that was built. We opened in October of 2013, so it'll be 10 years this year. And we provide a myriad of services to our local veterans. We have what we call RCFE, Residential Care Facility for the Elderly. That's what most people refer to as like assisted living. Those are for residents who are still kind of moving and grooving. Many of them still drive, get around, do their own thing, leave pretty independent lives. And then there's skilled nursing. Those are, of course, a higher level of care for skilled nursing. And then we have a memory care unit. So the memory care unit and the skilled nursing units have nurses on staff. We have 3 doctors that work here at the facility. We have our own clinic. When we're full, we have upwards of 300 people that live here. We have individual rooms. We even have a couple of couple rooms for those couples that live here. Non-veteran spouses also live here at the home. And we have a full, vibrant activities department. We have our on-site recreational therapists, physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists. We try to provide as much service on-site as we can, but then we also partner with our local VA hospital in providing medical services. And we have upwards of over 350 people that actually work here. So we have a lot of people that work here and a lot of people to care for our veterans.
So it's been almost 10 years. How many of those original residents 10 years ago still live here?
Well, we have a couple. We have resident number 1, Bill Carr, who still lives here. I'd say out of the original, what I call the original 30, there's maybe three that are left. That's the hard part about working here. You spend as much time here with these veterans as you do with your own family, so they become part of your family. And you get to know them, for better or for worse. We share all the ups and downs and highs and lows of life together. It's just our honor to work here, truly. It's been life-changing for me to work here.
Do you ever find yourself walking through a particular part of this big complex and a memory strikes in and it's a veteran who's no longer with us that you got to know and made an impression or shared a story with you?
All the time. All the time. In the dining room, we were just talking about golf, and Gordon Scott, who you remember, was very involved in the golf world. And I remember having many Monday morning conversations with him after a big golf tournament, and talking to him about golf and his life and his experiences. And we shared a lot of really wonderful, wonderful conversations. And again, that's part of working here is you aren't always in your office. You're roaming around. You're talking to the residents. And honestly, that's all they want from you is a little bit of your time. They want somebody to talk to. They want somebody to share experiences with. And, you know, your time's free. Why not give some of it?
There are a lot of ways you can help at a state veterans home near you. And we're going to learn more about the new memorial being planned. You can find artist renderings of it online at hometownheroesradio.com. But Julie mentioned one name that's going to be inscribed on that wall, Gordon Scott. He went on to run the Northern California Golf Association. But that never would have happened if he hadn't survived the sinking of the carrier USS Lexington in the Battle of the Coral Sea in May of 1942.
Some of our scout planes sighted the Japanese fleet in carriers and cruisers, battleships and everything. We sent planes and attacked them and sank one carrier and damaged another one. And then the next day, our planes were going back and attack them again. They had spotted us in the meantime. In mid-flight, here was a fleet from the care their carriers coming back to attack us. And they passed each other going, we're going to attack them and they're coming to attack us. Well, they got to us about 11 o'clock in the morning. They came in with dive bombers and torpedo planes. We took one torpedo hit on the port side and took two bomb hits, one in the superstructure on the starboard side and another bomb hit on one of the gun stations on the port side. There was a lot of damage, but our planes came back, and we had never had over an 8-degree list on the ship, and we landed, got back into the wind to land our planes that were coming back from attacking them, and landed our planes back, didn't land all of them, but we landed the ones that were there. Then they were refueling our planes to go back for another attack, and apparently it had ruptured some gasoline lines internally in the ship and was spewing gas out. That's very high octane gas, and it started burning up inside. And indirectly, the Japanese didn't sink us from their bomb hits or torpedo hits, but our ship burned up. That was at 11 something in the morning, and we didn't abandon ship till 5:18 that night.
And you're describing that, and I'm thinking, what did that look like? What did that feel like? And as you described, you still had to land your plane, so you're still there at your duty station, and your ship is damaged and on fire. Let's start here, maybe. Can you help us understand what that felt like when the torpedo and those bombs hit the Lexington?
I was about to, what we call the barrier cables that stop the planes if they're going to crash. Needless to say, people say they're not scared. I think they're damn liars. But was back right by the superstructure. And when we were attacked, pretty good jolt when you get a torpedo hit and a bomb hit, or one of the bomb hits in the superstructure right above us where we were. And I don't know, it's quite a feeling. It's hard to explain, really. We would send crews down fighting the fire internally. In the Navy, from where the ship was first built, I think they painted every week for an inspection. And I don't know how thick the paint was on the metal between and all the compartments, but they had doors that you could what call them, dog them down with latches on them and close them like locking a door in a house. It would get so hot on one side, it would start paint burning on the other side. So literally, that just went from compartment to compartment and dogging them down, burning, crews going down. Then people more and more began coming up on the flight deck. We had a little over probably 2,000 people aboard the ship. I don't know if there wasn't 2,000 up there because there were still people going down and fighting the deal. and just waiting. I mean, a period of waiting, that was from 11 to 5 o'clock that night, just laying there, just ship burning up internally. People would get a little scared, and they'd take life rafts, rubber life rafts that were in the planes, and inflate them, throw them over the side, and there's quite a bit of current in the ocean, and these life rafts would just float away. One of the deals that I think it was, if I remember right, it was probably 5:18 that night when they told us to abandon ship. I'll never forget it. There was a destroyer that came alongside, and I went down, and I was in the water and got picked up by the destroyer. I looked up, and here was a guy that was one of the squadron. We called him Porky Pref. He was in the torpedo squadron. Had inflated a big three-man or five-man life raft, and he tied a line to his wrist and another one to the raft and had some guys throw it over the side. Well, I was down on the destroyer, just got picked up, and I looked up, and here he come. He forgot how far it was to the water, and that the raft got down to the water before he did. And I never seen the guy again for several years.
So you weren't in the water all that long? You got picked up quickly?
Got picked up and was later transferred to a cruiser, the USS Portland, transferred to a cruiser. And we were black from smoke and kind of sick and scared and everything else. And it was then starting to get dark, and we just laid down in one of the compartments of the ship. And cruisers have a couple seaplanes that they send up in scouting for the cruisers. That morning they shot one off, and we thought, my God, here we go again, someone's bombing the ship. But they had just shot one of the cruiser planes off.
So the Lexington went down there in May of 1942, and obviously you survived, and a lot were able to get off. You talked about the abandoned ship. When did you realize how many fellow sailors you lost that day?
We ended up in the Tonga Islands. We were in Tonga Tabu in the Tonga group. Tonga is several different islands. When we were there, well, there was a hospital ship there. So a lot of our people were injured, went there, and several of them even died afterwards on the hospital ship. And a lot of people had to stay there. The rest of us were put on a transport that was in Tonga. We stopped back at Pearl Harbor and picked up some Marines that had been going back to the U.S. We came back to San Diego. We pulled in what they called a destroyer base. It's in the south from downtown San Diego, way back in the destroyer base. That was in late afternoon, and they announced that anybody that had families in San Diego could go ashore that night. Well, I had a brother that was a foreman in one of the aircraft plants in San Diego, so I got to go ashore, and went down to the aircraft plant there, and he worked on a late night shift. Went up to the security there and told him who I was, and I was dungarees and no uniform, and the guy kind of looked at me suspiciously, and he radioed in or called in on the phone and got a hold of my brother, and he came out, and he couldn't believe it. He says, "Did you desert the Navy?" We weren't supposed to tell anybody, but I had to tell him what happened, and we got back, and later they issued us clothing and everything the next day and got us all straightened out. Got to come back home to Kingsburg and still hadn't said anything. I was walking down the streets here in Kingsburg when it came back and out in the news, and there was a fellow here from the Kingsburg Recorder newspaper that hunted me down and wanted to know what happened.
Your ship's been sunk. Your brother doesn't know about it. Nobody knows about it. But here all of a sudden you are, and they're wondering why. That had to be a pretty surreal kind of stretch of time there.
Yeah, it was. It was quite a deal. But I was fortunate. I got to come back to Kingsburg for a short time. Went back to San Diego after about 3 or 4 weeks. There's six of us. They divided us up in different sections. At first they tried to see if we couldn't get another carrier that was being built or about ready to get out of building. And rename it the Lexington and put the whole crew on it, but they couldn't do that. So they divided our V1 division, which was the resting gear on the carrier, and they sent six of us to the Naval Air Station and shipyards in Philadelphia. And they were just starting a training school there. They were building so many Jeep carriers and other carriers at that time, they didn't have people trained really to man the deals. So they were setting up a deal, and they used the six of us for a while there in the training program to set it up. And then after about possibly a month, we were transferred to Norfolk, Virginia, to the naval base there. Went aboard another carrier, the USS Sewanee. And after a short time, we went out to sea, had a group of new pilots qualifying. Some of them hadn't been landing on carriers. That was an experience, too, because there was a lot of accidents. And then after maybe a week or two, we got left out of there and went to Bermuda. Then we done the same thing. We came out of Bermuda and trained more pilots, landing more. We had a catapult on this carrier, launching planes and landing them back and training everybody on the ship. And might say that basically, by and large, the biggest percentage of the personnel on the ship had never been to sea before. We had one experience to show the lack of training. They had a plane hooked up on a catapult, and we were going to sea, and it sounded flight quarters. And this plane, normally you would never hook a plane up with a catapult. You put what they call a bridle up on the plane and attach it to the catapult. And this was all hooked up there. And I was there talking to one of the guys that was with us, leaning against the plane, and turned and went to the bridge just to get adjacent to us. And I heard a click, and I turned around, and here this plane had been fired off of the catapult and mowing people down, going down the deal. No one in the plane, and the plane wasn't turning up, and it was terrible. This friend of mine that had been there, the plane just run right over him. He'd hurt his back real bad, and he was in the hospital for a long time and killed, quite a few people and maimed a lot of people. And it was a terrible accident.
Again, I'm struck by something you said there. You said you had just walked away right before. If you had still been standing where you were, what would have happened to you?
That's right. I mean, I've been very lucky. Well, I think the good Lord looked after me. I tell you, there was a lot of times that I prayed out there when I was at sea. I don't know why I was picked to survive. And I just can't believe it. I mean, because there have been so many. There was other close calls would happen aboard ship a lot of times. I had one deal that a plane crashed, and I crawled under the turret of this big gun. And about that far, this plane crashed right into this thing. And so there's just so many things. A friend of mine, I'm standing one, we were having night carrier landings one time, and I'm standing talking to him, and was off of Honolulu out of Pearl Harbor. Prior to the war, we're training program, or people night flying and night carrier landings, and a plane comes in and busted one of the, what we call the cross-deck pennants that stops the planes, and it whipped around. I'd just been talking to him, and I turned around, and I hadn't got 10 yards away from him, and this plane crashed or busted this barrier cable or cross-deck pennant and hit him and took his leg off. We had a little net off the side of the ship like this, and it was dark, and they just heard somebody moaning and found him here in the net. But he was fortunate. He lost a leg. But, I mean, there are just so many things that crashes. Another time a plane chased me in the flight deck that was coming in for a landing. I was up on the flight deck, and I just bailed out over the side into where the gun turrets were down there. Knocked a guy flat down there, and I just head first. And this plane here, one wing was in the deck, flight deck, and the other one on top one of the guns down there. Just so many things that happened. Like I say, the good Lord had to be looking out for me.
The late Gordon Scott, one of more than 400 names that'll be displayed in perpetuity at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno, thanks to a new memorial to be unveiled this fall. We'll put a couple of other stories behind those names and let you know how you can help bring this ambitious project to fruition when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.